You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This week, President Donald Trump had a big win on immigration policy when the Supreme Court upheld his executive order on his temporary travel ban against predominantly Muslim countries. However, yesterday, the president was defied by a federal judge in California who ordered U.S. immigration authorities to reunite separated families on the border within 30 days. The preliminary injunction said children younger than five must be reunited within 14 days of that order. The ruling is in response to a lawsuit filed by an anonymous woman from the Democratic Republic of Congo who is separated from her 17-year-old girl and a 14-year-old boy who is separated from his Brazilian mother. The judge also issued a nationwide injunction on future family separations unless the parent is deemed unfit or doesn't want to be with the child. It requires the government to provide phone contact between parents and their children within 10 days. However, the substantive law hasn't changed all that much in terms of how people come to the border and apply for asylum. In fact, in a case called Flores v. Reno, there was a ruling that limited the U.S. government's ability to hold immigrant children to 20 days. South Sioux City immigration attorney Heidi Oleg-Mueller says the government still has a lot of discretion in this matter.
The law, as it exists by Congress, says that detention can happen. It's these other cases that have made it where, okay, we're going to take special, you know, look at children. And through prosecutorial discretion, which is the discretion of the Attorney General and the Department of Homeland Security, separating parents from their minor children just hadn't happened. So in the past few years, several years, in fact, if a parent were to appear at the border seeking asylum and passed what's called a credible fear interview, they would be allowed in and then put into immigration proceedings. So there wasn't detention or ongoing detention per se that was happening. And then most recently, the president, within his discretion, said, no, the law allows us to actually separate parents from their children and prosecute each and every person entering without authorization under the Immigration and Nationality Act. So that's kind of where we're at up until then he issued his executive order saying that wasn't going to happen anymore.
So basically, though, are these people still being held, or the parents still being held, but they're being held with their children?
Yes. So that's, the children were in contradiction to the Flores a settlement agreement. The children were still and are still being held. So the executive order is a little bit fuzzy, in my opinion, in that it says that they won't separate so long the children from their parents so long as there are resources available for detention together, first of all. But it doesn't give a time limit on how long are we going to hold these children with their parents, you know, secondly. And it goes against the letter of the law in Flores, where we're not detaining young children. So the agreement, or the order, excuse me, doesn't release the children. It's just saying, okay, well, we're going to detain you with your parents now, as opposed to what we've been doing in the past and under the Flores settlement agreement, where minor children aren't going to be detained.
I see this somewhat as the president laying down the law and saying, you know, this is the hard line. If you come in here illegally and we find out, you're going to have to suffer the consequences. A lot of people have been concerned about the consequences for the children.
That's right. I think it very much is a hard line approach to what the president perceives as illegal immigration. One thing that I think people don't understand, just in, you know, comments that I receive and questions that I get asked, is that our law allows for people to present themselves at our ports of entry and borders seeking asylum. That's how our immigration law is written. It's not the same as a refugee who is approved based on a persecution ground, or, you know, fleeing for their safety in a third country. Asylum allows seeking the same protection but showing up at our borders. So I truly believe that the president's hardline approach is saying, we're not even going to let you come here and seek asylum, which, if if you focus on the people who are coming and the countries they're coming from, there's real crisis and violence, you know, drug activity, gang activity, all of those things. And so the hard line is, we're going to take your children away and hopefully not have you come here seeking asylum. The treatment of those children absolutely is what has, you know, garnered the most attention. But I think the covert undoing of what our existing asylum law is needs to have a look as well.
Do we know how many people are now being held?
The statistics, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, of which I'm a member, tries to publish like daily statistics and looking for pro bono help and things like that. My last glance, I think, was a couple days ago, and it was upwards of almost 35,000 people. So it's significant.
How can this go on? In terms of practicality with the government housing and feeding and basically being responsible for all these people. It doesn't seem reasonable that it can go on just in terms of that for very long.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Department of Homeland Security itself issued estimated budgets for detention of border crossers. And they said that the cost to taxpayers amounts to almost $134 per day to hold an adult immigrant in detention, and then an individual family, so at least one other child, $319 per day. So, yes, it definitely, fiscally, it can't go on for too long. Alternatives to detention have been used in the past for parents crossing with their children, like ankle monitoring, checking in with ICE, things like that. Those estimates are that costs the U.S. government around $4.50 a day. And again, this is the Department of Homeland Security's own budgetary report. So there's a stark difference. And not to mention just the trauma of holding these children and now trying to reconnect them with family members and all of the, you know, the manpower that entails.
And from what I've heard, some of those children, I don't know how many of these minors, maybe not children, but teenagers, are here without family.
That's true. 2012, 2013, the years are running together anymore. When we saw what people referred to as the border surge with the unaccompanied minors crossing the border, those are people under 18 that don't appear with a parent. So the past treatment of them has been to give them a credible fear interview as well, take them into custody, and then release them to what's called the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is kind of like a Department of Health and Human Services type of release. And then if they have a family member that can sign for them, they're released to that family member here in the United States. They would fall under the executive order right now, too, as far as who's being detained.
It seems like before I've talked to people about this whole catch and release idea, which sounds like fishing, and now this way of doing things, it seems like neither one of these work all that well. So it seems like it's really hard to find an answer to this issue.
I agree. And the whole phrase catch and release is, it's a little misleading, because Border Patrol has the ability to issue what's called an expedited removal. So you're being deported from the border. You're not taken into custody for extended periods of time, but you are being deported from the border. So when people talk about catch and release, there's serious consequences to having been apprehended at the border as well. And just because we're not taking you into custody and prosecuting, you know, a person, doesn't mean they're not suffering some sort of consequences. There also is this idea that before the laws weren't being enforced so strictly or rigidly, and you were caught, but then you were voluntarily returned. That definitely happened, and I don't think it happens right now under the zero tolerance policy that the president has set forth. But there was discretion, which immigration law is very personal, and asylum and refugee processing, there is a lot of discretion that goes into who's approved and who's not approved. I think the bigger issue is truly looking at what's going on in these Northern Triangle countries of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and figure out what can we do as a nation to try to help alleviate some of what's going on there. Because if you put your, if you look at it, and you as a parent or your young child, and you're sending, or you're sending your young child alone to make this dangerous trip, and you're saying that's honestly better than what we're dealing with on the, you know, day to day in our home country, the facts have to be pretty bad. And I think we need a bigger view of all of that. And that needs to be discussed.
That was South Sioux City immigration attorney Heidi Olig-Miller talking about the status of U.S. immigration law and how it's affecting thousands of illegal immigrants being held at the border with Mexico. Yesterday, a federal judge in California ordered U.S. immigration authorities to reunite separated families on the border within 30 days. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. America's relationship with immigrants has always been complicated. Back in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in the Midwest, immigrants largely from Europe flooded Iowa, Minnesota, Nebraska, and the Dakotas with hopeful farmers who took up homesteads. They were vital members of their communities, but they were sometimes seen as dangerous foreigners. Yankton native Sarah Egge found a surprising thread of nativism in her research on woman suffrage and the power of community building in Iowa, Minnesota, and South Dakota. These women took on civic roles that helped them eventually win the vote. Egge's new book, Woman Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest, 1870 to 1920, shows how important women were in creating and shaping public attitudes in the American heartland. Egge is an assistant professor of history at Center College in Danville, Kentucky. She says people who came to the Midwest wanted to build civilization as they saw it, and the women wanted to build their communities through service and hard work.
Yeah, they just really push for, I don't know, this just strong sense of engaging in community affairs and then pushing for public institutions. Yeah, so they're really big on trying to get people to engage in their communities and really for the benefit of all, not just for themselves. And so when they do that, that really helps them to think about what it means to be a citizen. And that starts this idea that citizens are engaged. They understand responsibility and obligation. And so for them, that kind of in the idea of citizenship, the concept of citizenship, it pushes them more toward this idea of obligation rather than just rights, that you need to be active, in other words.
Now, in your book, you give examples of how women in Northwest Iowa's Clay County, South Dakota's Yankton County, and also Minnesota's Lyon County work to improve their communities.
Yes. So that's something that I think I wasn't quite expecting, the level of engagement from women. And I think a lot of other people who have looked at this maybe missed it or didn't just assume that it was mostly men doing this. Because oftentimes on the surface, that's what you see in newspapers, in material that was produced about kind of these institutions, these public community institutions, it's men's names. But if you just scratch below that surface, you're like, wow, there's a lot of women who are really the movers and shakers in these communities. And in particular, what I talk about in the book is that they are the ones that are raising money. They are these spectacular fundraisers. They just have the sort of money that they can raise is impressive. And so they are really pushing for their vision, which is to make better communities for their neighbors, for their families, for their children, for themselves.
You use the term municipal housekeeping in the book. Where did that term come from?
It's a term that's actually made kind of public by Jane Addams in the kind of 19-teens. And it's a, so she was a progressive woman, progressive era woman, who was really big on kind of public service. She was leading the settlement house, the Hull House in Chicago. And so this was a term then that was sort of thrown out there. And a lot of these women who became suffragists were using this term as well. And it's interesting, in the Midwest, women, they knew about this concept and many of them embraced it and said, yeah, this is what we're doing. We see ourselves as sort of people who, we understand housekeeping, we understand what it takes to run a home, but now we're going to take those skills and we're going to put them into the streets and into, you know, the cities we're going to clean up our cities just as we do our homes.
So at what point did this actually cross over into helping them with the suffrage movement?
It happened slowly. Where I start to see this really crystallize is around, in the Midwest at least, is in that early 19-teens era. I really see it start to emerge. In particular, there's a campaign in 1914 in South Dakota. And in this campaign, this is really where the women start to say, these are local women in southeastern South Dakota in particular, who are saying, you know, we have had this long responsibility to our communities. We have raised funds to build libraries and schools. Many of them were members of churches, and they had done the same in their own churches. And they said, all of this that we have been doing has been for our communities. We understand what it takes to be good citizens. We have the civic responsibility. And so, don't you think it would be a good idea, you men who are the ones who are actually going to pass a women's suffrage amendment to enfranchise us, don't you think it would be a good idea to enfranchise us? And they start to put that into a message in around 1914, which also coincides with the beginning of World War One, which is important as well. The United States did not join World War One in 1914, but that was also part of the context. They were very much aware of that happening at the same time as these women's suffrage campaigns were happening in the Midwest.
By the end of the war, President Woodrow Wilson came out and admitted that they couldn't have won World War One without all the work of women.
So he changes his tune. The short story is that he was not favorable to women's suffrage for a long time. But it's really World War One where he finally gets on board and he starts to go to both parties, Democrats and Republicans, and say, look, we need to enfranchise women because they have been vital to winning the war. He gives this speech in the fall of 1918 where he basically says to Congress, you need to pass women's suffrage because women have been sacrificing, they've been giving, they've been serving the war effort as much as in many ways soldiers abroad. And so he really kind of channels that and pushes that forward. And I will say then for all these women who had been working on this kind of civic responsibility, that was sort of like vindication to them to hear him say, I and my fellow politicians recognize your service and your sacrifice. And for people in the Midwest, this message, among other messages that he gave in support of women's suffrage at that time, really resonated. People were like, oh, this makes sense. All the stuff that we've been seeing women do before the war and then during the war on behalf first for their communities and then for the nation when it was wartime, that mattered. And that was really a turning point for women to get the right to vote in the Midwest.
So how did immigrants, as you say in the book, become factors when it came to winning the vote for women?
So this is a really interesting thread that came out. And I talk a lot about this. I try to move through from the settlement era where you do have these native born, I call them Yankees. These are people who come to the Midwest. They have ties to the Northeast. They are the ones that really instill the spirit of volunteerism and civic responsibility and civic engagement. And they are settling at the same time that a lot of immigrants from Northern Europe are coming to the Midwest. And many, in fact, the largest group of immigrants at this time were Germans. And you, as you said, this is a region then that becomes very much known as a place where a lot of Germans live, this German culture. A lot of them maintain this, and in part they can do it because of the physical layout of the Midwest. As we know, it's very vast, and settlement at this time was quite isolated. We don't necessarily have in the late 19th century really great transportation. So these Germans, among others, there are certainly lots of Scandinavians. There's other groups, pockets of groups that I talk about when I talk about the three counties in my study. But what they are able to do is they are able to resist assimilation. And so they are able to speak German for a long time. They are able to celebrate their German holidays. They're able to send their kids to parochial church schools. And that becomes something that produces a lot of tension when we get to World War One, that nativism, that anti-immigrant sentiment that you're talking about, that's really where we start to see a lot of these native-born Midwesterners start to turn against their German immigrant neighbors and say, are you really loyal? Do you really understand what it means to be a citizen? And in that moment, that's really where suffragists kind of have this breakthrough where they say, not only have we been saying for years that we are citizens because we understand civic responsibility and community engagement, but now we have this other group that we can position ourselves against and say, they don't understand it. And then the key here is, and this is something that when I stumbled upon this, I was just shocked. And I think probably a lot of people have never heard of this, but in about 24 states, immigrants could vote before they became citizens. And in Minnesota and South Dakota, these two states gave immigrants the right to vote after 2 years of living in their states, their respective states. So for suffragists, native-born women who could not vote, this was just appalling that they were living among these immigrants who were, during World War One, they started to be seen with suspicion, and they could vote with 2 years residency and without finishing the naturalization process, the 5-year period of naturalization, and they could vote. So you get all these interesting variables that start to come together, and then all of this really helps for women, at least, to get the right to vote in the Midwest.
It does seem like in America, often one group, whether it's women or African Americans, can't really make progress without in some way tramping on the rights of another group. It seems difficult to make that work.
You know, it's hard. I get this question a lot because people say, well, it's just so unfortunate that the suffragists had to do this. And as a historian, I say, well, you know, that context, it's important to understand that. And we would look back on this and say, yeah, it looks like they're pushing, in this case, German immigrants to the side and really kind of scapegoating them. And it is, you know, certainly you sort of wish, but that's just not how it works, right? Like this is what they did. But in their minds, this made sense, right? Like this was a political maneuver. This is something else. I think a lot of times when we think about women, we think, especially before they got the right to vote, we wonder how politically engaged they were. And I make this argument, they were tremendously politically engaged and they wanted the right to vote. And even though we might look back and say, well, it's too bad that they did this, they saw this as a political maneuver, something that they could use to get people to support women's suffrage, especially at a time when that was very radical and they had been struggling for decades to try to get the right to vote and had been meeting hostility and opposition at every turn. This to them was the way to unlock that and figure it out and get the right to vote. So they were willing to do it. But it does make you wonder, right? There's always, I think, trade-offs. And ultimately, too, I will say the narrative is always messy, right? We like to think, oh, these women, they went out there, they advocated for themselves, they changed people's mind, and then they got the right to vote. And that's not what happened. And so getting to the bottom of the messiness, I think for me, that's one of the things that I want people to see, that there's complication to this and there's trade-offs.
You started working on this topic way back when you were still getting your PhD. You wrote your dissertation about it. And now the book comes out. It must be a really good feeling to be getting all this good feedback and have people appreciate what you've done.
Yeah, so I've been really happy to see and hear all the people who've given me good feedback on this. I've worked a long time on this. I actually started getting interested in this as an undergraduate student. I went to North Dakota State University, and I took a class on women's history. And I just thought, you know, there's really nothing on women's suffrage in the Midwest. I really want to know more, so I can continue to pursue it. I went to school at Iowa State University, got my PhD, wrote the dissertation on this subject, and then continued with the book. And I think for me, the thing that just resonates is the fact that so many of these issues, we're still talking about them. The players may have changed, some of the pieces of context are different, but the questions are still the same about what is a citizen? What are a citizen's rights and responsibilities? What is the role of the government in protecting citizens, non-citizens? And then certainly that complexity. I'm very much interested in this question of citizenship. I find it baffling and surprising. And certainly just the reality that there really isn't a clear answer. I definitely want to continue to pursue that and look at this historically to see how ideas of citizenship, expectations of citizenship don't necessarily match.
It seems so timely at the moment because of all the immigrants that are being held at the border and the big controversy over immigrants' rights and citizenship in America.
Right. Yeah, so this is the fun part of being a historian, is to tell people, you know, actually there was a time when we as a country welcomed immigrants with open arms. The Homestead Act is a great example. For 160 acres, you live there for 5 years, you get that land for free. You just got to farm it. And for these people, I mean, we wanted immigrants. Some scholars have argued that what I talked about before, the alien suffrage, giving immigrants the right to vote before they became citizens, was kind of part of that thinking, was we want to welcome them. We want them to participate in our government. We want them to be engaged citizens or people on the path to citizenship. And so that is one of the arguments about why, again, about 24 states enacted laws to give non-citizen immigrants the right to vote. And it resonates, I think, because a lot of times we think of current political questions about immigration, and we just think that that's how it's always been. And in fact, it's not. It's been actually the complete opposite. The Midwest is a great example of a place where immigrants for a long time were welcomed. And it's also a great example of a place where there was a lot of hostility and backlash after a few decades as political climates changed, in this case, World War I and the anti-German sentiment. And so I think for me, it's this question of when we think about immigrants coming in, we think about what rights they have. There were times where they had a lot of rights. They had the right to vote, right? That to me is one of the foundational things that we think about in our government, in our democracy, that people should enjoy and celebrate and exercise that right. So just, again, I think it complicates and makes it, hopefully it makes us kind of think a little bit more about why we are enacting the policies we're enacting and think about the consequences. In this case that I study, the consequences were that women got the right to vote, but they did so by scapegoating German immigrants.
That was Center College Assistant Professor of History Sarah Egge. She's the author of the book, Woman Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest, 1870 to 1920. The book looks at how women use their community-building power to help further their cause for the right to vote and how nativism entered into the woman suffrage issue. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. A week from today, we'll celebrate the 4th of July. Last year, in the wake of the state's decision to change the ban on setting off most fireworks in Iowa, Sioux City became one of the most lenient municipalities when it comes to discharging fireworks. Last year, Sioux Cityans could set off fireworks for several days around the 4th of July. However, hundreds of complaints from residents about noise, debris, and fears about fire made the city council change the rules. Now fireworks discharge is allowed between 1 and 11 p.m. July 3rd and 4th. City Council member Dan Moore says it was important to balance the needs of people and pet owners who were disturbed by the fireworks and those who want to show their patriotism on the nation's birthday.
Our primary concern, in addition to obeying what the law allows for, but our primary concern is really the safety of the citizens. And you have to be very careful when you're shooting off discharging fireworks. And so we want all citizens. We just don't want to hear about injuries. We don't want anybody to get hurt. We don't want, of all ages, adults, children, you just have to be very careful. So we haven't heard anything about why just 2 days, why can't it be 10 days, why can't it be, you know, a month. And I think we did the right thing, and we'll see how it plays out. The beauty of the law is that if we had to, we can change it. I mean, let's just say even 2 days is a disaster, and people prove that and they make their case for it. It's something we need to look at. It'd be very difficult, of course, not to have fireworks to discharge on the actual 4th of July, but we think we did a fairly good compromise there.
You know, driving across Iowa, you see a lot of towns, bigger towns, Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, Council Bluffs, and they're not allowing people to shoot off fireworks, and some people say, why are we doing it in Sioux City?
Mm-hmm. And that's a good question. It's a good point. One way that this elected official, the way I look at it sometimes, is we've historically, in the past, we have always had an issue with people discharging fireworks illegally. And do we try to enforce the law? Yes, we do. We do the best we can. But you have to have evidence that they were indeed the ones that were firing off the fireworks. I think it's difficult to ask our citizens to say, on the one hand, and even though it's state law and state mandated, it wasn't a city decision by any means, but it's state law that we can sell fireworks. I think it's very difficult then to tell our citizens, but you can't fire them off. You have to discharge those fireworks in either another community or somewhere where you can legally discharge fireworks. I think that's setting us up for failure for enforcing the fireworks. So I think it goes hand in hand. I think it's very difficult to say we're going to sell the fireworks, but you can't discharge them.
Do you feel good about the number of people selling, the number of stands and people selling fireworks out there? You think it's enough and not too much?
I think it's balanced. The numbers of those that are selling, the retailers that are selling and marketing fireworks, I think it's a pretty good balance right now. I think the market will bear that out. And I know that was a concern, Mary, last year about, are we going to have just a flood of retailers coming in, setting up either temporary shops or permanent shops, and will we be oversold, and will everybody be trying to discharge their fireworks, you know, so they don't have to carry them over to next year. They discharge all of them. And I'm not sure that happened. I think it's fairly well balanced.
That was Sioux City Council member Dan Moore talking about the use of fireworks next Wednesday, July 4th. Sioux City curtailed the number of days and hours that residents can discharge fireworks after last year when there were hundreds of complaints about noise and debris. With issues of public school funding regularly in the news, Kid Talk reporters Langston Saint and Katie Hartnett wondered, what is the value of the public school system? And here's what they had to say.
Today we want to share with you our enthusiasm for education and learning, and we have visited with some incredible educational leaders. One of those individuals is Perla Alarcon Flory, member of the Sioux City School Board, who sees education for all as her priority.
Every single child in Sioux City, in Iowa, in the nation, in the world, I believe in the human power. I believe in brain power. So I believe in education.
Hey Langston, I'm really glad we have people like Mrs. Alarcon Flory caring about our education. But come on, we're just kids. Why should we spend time right now talking about education?
Without a great education, life can be tough. My parents have taught me to really appreciate what we have here in our country and never to take it for granted.
Trying to raise successful citizens and individuals that can pretty much find the jobs that they need and that can be very good members of society in the future.
Well, I really like activities in school where we go outside. I'm not sure that school always gets me there. I also like to move around in the classroom.
In my head, the perfect school has plenty of teachers, lots of desks, supplies, and it's open to everyone. In my school, we work quite a bit with technology. I really like coding, and coding is a way I can express myself. When I visited with Superintendent Dr. Gosman, he talked about those schools and was really excited about this new concept in learning.
We've changed our perspective on how students learn today, and it's not as much about that picture you might have had from a long time ago where you open up the brain and you pour in all the knowledge. It doesn't work that way anymore. It's really about the students engaging in activities that allow them to create knowledge.
Hey, I get it. There are a lot of things I like to do, and my school, Bryant, offers me opportunities to explore a bit, and I can't wait for the new school to be finished. It will be amazing. I've heard Mom talking about teachers and the building and things like a budget, you know, things that make the school work.
The budget is a big, big deal, and my folks talk about it a lot.
When you interviewed Dr. Gosman, did he talk about budget at all?
Oh, yes, he did.
I've never been in a state that felt like they were getting enough money for education, and so you're always trying to find a way to do more things for kids with just a little less funding than you might like to have.
How do they decide what is best for kids in raising achievement?
We've got to always get back to our roots, and so it's often an inquisitive process, a process where we ask ourselves questions a lot and make certain that we're designing programs to yield the proper answers to those questions.
Local legislator Chris Hall understands the importance of a good education for all, and how our government sets the goal for educating everyone.
And the benefit of public schools is that they are open access. That means any child who lives in a certain community is guaranteed access to a school and to certain levels of education by the government. So it means that we will provide for that student 12 years of education all the way through high school.
You know what I say, a goal without a plan is just a wish.
And a plan without effort is useless. Sounds like folk such as Chris Hall have their work cut out for them.
Kid Talk is a collaboration between Kid Scoop News and our project with the Siouxland Media Lab. It's supported by the Gilchrist Foundation, the Siouxland Community Foundation, and the Junior League. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. A hit song from the 1940s put Sioux City on the map.
Sioux City Sioux, your hair is red, your eyes are blue, I swap my horse and dog for you. Sioux City Sioux, there ain't no gal as true.
And that was a cover of the song Sioux City Sioux by Willie Nelson and Leon One. Now the owner of Radio Records hopes to see lightning strike twice with a hip-hop remix of the same song. Our arts producer, Ellie Carson, talks to Richard Miller about the new release.
Sioux City Sioux,
Sioux City,
where are you?
Where you at, girl?
Sioux City Sioux, where are you?
I'm just going to hit record and see what happens.
Okay. It was nothing.
Yeah, right? So I wanted to play this for you. Mm-hmm. This is Gene Autry, Sioux City Sioux, from 1946.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You've probably heard this one.
I drove a herd of cattle down from old Nebraska way. That's how I come to be in the state of Iowa. I met a gal in Iowa, her eyes were big and blue. I asked her what her name was, she said Sioux City Sioux. Sioux City Sioux, Sioux City Sioux. Your hair is red, your eyes.
So, you've heard that song before.
Yes.
Yeah.
Love it.
So then, how did you come to the state of Iowa?
Okay. A long story short, pretty much I wanted to come out here. I simply put a globe in front of me and said, you know, what was a place that I've never been or would never go to in my lifetime? And, you know, Iowa was a place I knew nothing about, didn't even know what was there. And, you know, when I Googled it, you know, what are the big cities? Sioux City came up. And Briarcliff was kind of the only school that popped up, which was really weird, but it was the only school that popped up. And I actually called and wanted to get a scholarship. I played football and I knew that I was pretty good at it. So I was like, I can get a scholarship just about anywhere. So I'm originally from Miami, Florida. And I graduated out of Atlanta, Georgia. So I went to Westlake High. Woo-woo. And from there, came out here to Sioux City.
Okay. So I'm just picturing you, you know, with an old globe, just like giving that thing a good spin and the finger goes
absolutely
on it. And that's what happened. And that's why you're here today.
That's why I'm here. Yeah. It was really random, really spontaneous. My mom was freaking out and was like, you really gonna go that far? Like, I don't know. It was like, is there any black people out there? I was like, I don't know. I'm just going, you know. And yeah, it was, she didn't want me to go at all.
So why Iowa? I mean, how did you find it? Unless it really was that you just pointed on a map. No.
Yeah. I seriously did do it that way. When I touched down, you know, because I came here on the bus, on Greyhound. Shout out to Greyhound. I came on Greyhound and with a bag and $12 is what I had, you know, to start out with here. And it was just, I said, you know, if I could come here and if I can make it here, I can make it anywhere. So I said, if I could survive here and, you know, and become somebody and do something great, you know, in a place that is completely opposite of everything that I knew, then I knew that I could be prepared for anything in the world. And that's how everything started.
Yeah. So that's been almost 10 years ago.
Yes. Yes.
And you're still here.
I am still here.
Yeah. So what have you found here? Did you find Sioux City Sue? Did you come looking for her?
Well, pretty much when I first touched down here, mind you, in 2008, my class was the largest minority class recruited thus far at Briarcliff. So we were like the, you know, the first of the urban community to arrive at, you know, and it was like it was a ton of us that came, you know, it was a ton of at least like 50 of us from all over the place, you know, just in sports, you know, to begin with, as far as football is concerned. So we had people from Milwaukee, from Miami, Florida, from Texas, from, you know, Louisiana. I mean, it was from all over the place and they came for sports. And you know, when we all got there, we all had the same opinion. It was just like, where are we? What is, you know, what is going on? And but, you know, a lot of the guys from my class did move, you know, back home and things like that. And I'm one of the few that actually stayed, you know, that is not, you know, traditionally from, you know, the tri-state area. So,
yeah.
And I came here not looking for Sioux City Sioux, but pretty much just looking to make something of myself. And you know, and I was a kid back then. So, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do, what I was interested in. I just knew that, you know, if I can make it in here in some kind of form or fashion that, you know, that I accomplished, you know, what I wanted to accomplish. So I've always been in music. I got the gift of music from my parents. My mother and father met in church and my dad was a musician and my mom was a singer. So there was a church conference, you know, because they both went to separate churches and there was a conference between each other. And my mother went up to sing a song and her musician didn't show up. So when my father was there, he wanted to do, you know, just be kind and courteous and go up and play behind her. And that's how they met. My father definitely instilled, you know, music and he said, it's good to learn a skill because you never know what can possibly save your life one day. And that's what he said. And I didn't understand what he was saying back then. Now I do, because music is such a huge part of my life.
Yeah, so then what led you to do this hip-hop remix of Sioux City Sue?
Sioux City is really interesting in regards to music is concerned. Sioux City is largely your rock and country. That is the base, you know, of Sioux City. But there are small pockets, you know, in Sioux City that deal with hip hop and that deal with rap and that deal with reggae and things like that. Little pockets in Sioux City that really dive into those genres of music. And when I came, you know, it's from the time of me touching down here back in 08 till now, I've seen that dynamics kind of change. I've seen the hip hop community grow. I've seen the reggae community grow and get, you know, kind of introducing that music to different people and different walks of life. So I figured that if I did something that kind of blended the two worlds, that it would definitely open up a door and introduce people who would normally listen to hip hop and possibly find a love for it.
Yeah, because the history of Sioux City Sue, you know, it was recorded by Dick Thomas mm-hmm. in 1945, mm-hmm. and then that was turned into a film the following year. And, you know, we heard earlier Gene Autry singing mm-hmm. that song, and it's also been covered by Bing Crosby and Slim Whitman, the Andrews Sisters.
The number, yeah.
And now you.
Yeah, and now me. I'm the baby.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, and it was hit number one on the country charts. Mm-hmm. Was the first that was with Dick Thomas when he did it. You know, mm-hmm. that was on the country charts.
Yeah,
and now we have this hip hop version of it today.
Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting. The playoff from the storyline was. I definitely wanted to modernize, you know, the storyline and definitely say, okay, they had their experience, you know, as far as creating a storyline of Sioux City Sue and what that meant. And, you know, honestly, how I came across the song was this. I said, what is being done from a musical standpoint for Sioux City? What is a song that has definitely impacted Sioux City and put Sioux City on the map? And that then I came across, you know, the Sioux City Sioux. Mm-hmm. And I listened to the song and it was a very interesting story. So I said, you know, let's modernize that.
Radio Records.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sioux City Sioux. What up?
Yeah, yeah,
Sioux City,
yeah.
Stand up.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
See, I'm looking for this girl. And her name is Sioux City Sioux. So if you seen her, holla at me, yeah. Sioux City Sioux,
Sioux City,
where are you?
Where you where at, girl? You?
Sioux City Sioux, where are you?
Yeah,
Sioux City, where you
yeah,
at, girl?
Yeah.
Sioux City Sioux,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where are you?
Sioux City, what
yeah,
up?
Yeah, yeah. Sioux City Sioux, where are you? I'm looking for this girl named Sioux City Sioux. Excuse me, sir, tell me, have you seen her? Long red hair, eyes blue like Aquafina. Came to Sioux City hoping that I can find her. It's a long story, so let me sit down first. Yeah. I heard a song about a girl in Sioux City Sioux. So yeah. I came to Sioux City just to see if it's true. It said she had long red hair and light blue eyes. Real nice girl, but she had a crazy side. She yeah. stood about 5'6", about yay high. Was yeah. wearing blue jeans with a design on the side. So yeah. I saw her at the airport when I touched down. But yeah. then I lost her every time I put my bags down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe I could catch her at the mall, you think?
Yeah.
You can call me if you ever see her, you think?
Yeah.
Well, I gotta stay on my search. So thank you for listening, sir. Sioux City, Sioux.
Sioux City, what's up?
And that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. We'll see you next Wednesday on the 4th of July. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks to Allie Carson.
Sioux City, what up?
Where are you?
Where are you at?
Sioux City, Sioux, where are you? Trying to find this girl in Sioux City, Sioux. So I hopped out my car and headed to the mall.
Yeah.
And I grabbed a couple dollars so that I can ball.
Yeah.
Walked around just to see if she was there. Then I looked to my left and saw a flash of red hair.
where are you?
Sioux City, what up?
Sioux City Sue, where are you?
I'm looking for this girl in Sioux City Sue.
Sioux City Sue,
Sioux City, what up?
Where are you?
Sioux City, what up?
Sioux City Sue, where are you?
Sioux City, what up? Radio Records.